And good afternoon and welcome to Visions in Sound. My name is Rob Daniels. Well, last week was my 7th anniversary show, and this week is the official start of the Visions in Sound summer series, and I thought I would kick it off in grand style. This week's program features the music of composer Mark Isham. I will say this, one show cannot even begin to touch what Mark has achieved since Never Cry Wolf in 1983. His list of credits is amazing, like Blade, Rules of Engagement, Never Cry Wolf. Just the list goes on and on and on and on, and it's just, I was like, when I was reading through the credits, I was going, oh, I'm not going to be able to fit this into one program, and I'm hoping that I'll be able to connect again with Mark, and we'll do a second interview coming up in the fall. But anyway, like I said, we'll touch on just some of his scores today, and I'll also have an interview that was recorded around the same time as the film Next, starring Nicolas Cage, came out. Now, before I get to that interview, I thought I would start with the music that kind of got things going for Mark. Here is some of the music from the 1983 film, Never Cry Wolf. Thank you.
Thank you.
And with just a little bit of music from the 1983 film Never Cry Wolf. That's music by Mark Isham. Well, if you're interested in any of the film, television, or video game music that I do play here on Visions and Sound, you can contact me here at the station at 884-CKMS. That's 884-2567. You can also try me online at visionsinsound2000 at hotmail.com. You can also, if you have Rogers Digital Cable, you can now hear us on channel 946. Well, welcome back to Visions and Sound as I'm presenting the music of Mark Isham. Well, I'm going to get to a little bit of an interview that I did with him. This is part one of that interview, and I'll be back with some more of his music, and we'll be back in a bit.
What is your musical background?
Well, I was fortunately born into a very musical family. My mother is a professional violinist, and my father was a professor of amateur violist and a professor of music and history. So there was a lot of music in the household growing up. I took to it, and it was something I was very interested in from a very early age. I played piano, violin for a while, and I discovered trumpet actually from being taken to orchestra rehearsals by my mother. I liked the guys in the back row there. They seemed to be the really cool guys. Picked up the trumpet and made it my life's work. Discovered composition sort of along the way. I always liked picking notes, you know, little tunes out on the piano and making up little pieces, and explored that, you know, through school, through high school. I started writing a bit in my 20s, really decided to make music my life, and basically self-taught, however.
Oh, really?
I don't have a degree. I just started looking at the music that impacted me emotionally. If I had heard a record that I just said, wow, and after enjoying it for a while, then I would sort of sit down and start to pick it apart and say, well, now, I want to know why I enjoy this so much. You know, what are they doing here that creates these effects that can make me feel like that? I thought that was so cool, you know. And the next thing you know, I'm doing it for a living.
So, what was it that drew you to film and television instead of just the concert stage?
It was really an opportunity presented itself. You know, I knew that people did that for a living. They wrote music for movies, obviously. I was a big fan of Henry Mancini, and mm-hmm. I loved that fusion of orchestral music and jazz, and always admired music and film. But for some reason, it never occurred to me that was something that I could or should or would want to do mm-hmm. until a film director heard some music that I had written and said, you could, should, and would should want to do this, and I'd like you to do it for me, and offered me the opportunity to try it. And it was a tough first thing. I was trial by fire. I sort of just, you know, he threw me in the deep end, and fortunately I figured it out. And then this was Carol Ballard, by the way.
Oh, yes.
And the film was Never Cry Wolf. It took 4.5 months to get that score done, and, you know, working 7 days a week, and, you know, 10, 12, 14-hour days, and but I got through it, and then went back to being a trumpet player again. But a few months afterwards, I said, you know, that was one of the most rewarding experiences of my life. Maybe I should look into continuing that.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing you know, that movie came out, and a young agent who was just starting off his career approached me, and I said, well, sure, give me some more work. I'd love to do it. And that was basically how my career started.
Okay. So what is the first thing that you do when you begin to write a score?
I try to narrow down the basic parameters of what I think will achieve the results. We live in a time now when music, when you say the word music, it's infinite.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it can go all the way from pure abstract noise down to, you know, Gregorian chant, and with every, you know, ethnic influence. I mean, it's such a wide palette now with our, you know, globalization and electronic music and the technology, that just to say, well, this film needs music is over an overwhelming understatement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important that if the director and the editor and music editor, if they haven't done this already, to sit down with them and really sort of hone it in. And even if they have honed it into a degree, that's still the job that I feel I have to do. I now have to find my personal boundaries, and as it were, what's the vocabulary here? Is it going to be you know, seven violins and ukulele, or is it going to be a more traditional orchestra, or is it going to be all electronic, or what is the texture of this? What it was, you know, like a cinematographer will say, well, what are the colors of this movie? You know, are we shooting this in browns and yellows, or are we shooting this all in primary colors? Or I think you have to do the same thing with music. And not to say that it can't evolve. Obviously, it's going to evolve. And sometimes, you know, your first or second pass will get thrown out completely. But unless I find, for myself, unless I make some sort of a choice, at least to get started, the overwhelming number of possible choices make it very difficult to get started.
So now, as a composer, you deal with many different styles of music. How do you prepare for writing in a specific style?
Well, that will depend on the style. If it's a style that I feel fairly comfortable in and that I have a fair amount of experience in, there really won't be any preparation needed. If in this sort of initial exploratory phase I've come across an idea that needs to borrow from a type of a style or a genre that I'm not that familiar with, I definitely will have to go and do some homework.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for instance, on Black Dahlia last year, I knew I wanted a film noir influenced score. I knew I wanted it to be big. It had to be bold. You know, it had to match De Palma's filmmaking style.
Yes.
But the fact that it was going to be influenced more in the orchestral jazz world, and by that I say more like Leonard Bernstein rather than Gil Evans,
mm-hmm.
what was a push for me. That was a sort of an area that I wasn't that intimately familiar with. So I did some homework. I bought some Bernstein scores, I listened to some of his music, and because I wanted the music to have a certain level of complexity that Bernstein's music has, that you can bring not only the complexity that jazz has to offer, but you can bring that sort of 20th century orchestral writing and you can blend them. And he was the master at that. I mean, it was really, it was quite a wonderful learning experience for me, because I'd never really gone back and, as I mentioned earlier, you know, picked it apart and say, well, how does he create an effect like that? You know, and then if I were to look at that and say, well, how can I use that? How can I make that something that would be my own, you know, idea, but based on that knowledge?
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example of a certain amount of research. Obviously, if a film also has a certain ethnic influence, you know, and a, you know, let's say a Chinese element, I might go back and research, you know, Chinese music for a while. Although in cases like that, I try not to be too, you know, dogmatic about it. I'd like to stay as like impressionistic. I learn just enough to break all their rules, but to have the flavor sprinkled on top.
Right. So how did you come to first work on the film Bobby?
Well, that film I heard about. You know, I insist with my agent that we have, you know, at least monthly meetings, and which they, you know, the guys in the agency, you know, give me what's happening, you know, what's slipping under the radar, what has nobody else heard about that you guys have heard rumors about. And I remember one meeting, this guy, one of the agents said, well, you know, I've heard that Emilio has this movie called Bobby that he's written and he's going to direct. And my ears pricked up. It's just one of those things that even just sort of hearing the rumor about it, I said, that sounds pretty interesting. And I just had him follow it along. Once they were into it and going and the movie was getting a buzz that it attracted this tremendous cast, I just said, all right, find me Emilio's phone number. I want to call him.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And I said, look, Emilio, you got a buzz on this movie. I want to score it.
Okay. So do you treat a historical film any differently than you would a fictional one?
I think with a historical film, it depends on the film. Certain historical films, you want to be right there in the period of time,
mm-hmm.
especially, I think, if they're more plot-driven. Maybe that's the wrong way to say that. I mean, what I'm trying to say is a film like Bobby, which is obviously about a story, but we know what the story is. We actually know exactly what happens
mm-hmm.
there. So the film is about more than that. The film is about what Bobby represents. The film is about what Bobby's life, what Bobby's ideals, the impact they can have upon more ordinary people and people from various different walks of life, and how we can relate to those various different people and what those ideals can be for us now you know, 40, 50 years later.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what that movie's about. So it wasn't necessarily that important to keep the score connected to that period of time, because, in fact, it was more important to make the score sort of rise up above the movie and not be too specific, because you want people to think about, well, how does this relate to me? You know, what can I do with this experience? What can I learn from, you know, the ideals that Bobby offered the world? So that there were some subtle hints that might tie it, but nothing that was going to just, you know, in fact, like I said, the scores, the main thing I asked of the score was to sort of universalize the experience.
And that's just part one of the interview that I did with Mark Isham. If you're interested in any of the film, television, or video game music that I do play here on Visions and Sound, you can contact me here at the station at 884-CKMS. That's 884-2567. You can also try me online at visionsinsound2000@hotmail.com. Well, welcome back to Visions and Sound as we look at we're going to be looking at the scores of composer Mark Isham. Now, as mentioned in the last portion of the interview, Mark also scored the film Bobby. Now, here's a little bit of the score from that film, followed up by Eight Below and Of Mice and Men, two scores that I would have loved to talk more about, but unfortunately did not get the time, and perhaps next interview. Here is some music from Bobby.
Huh? Hey, hey. Oh, that feels better.
CKMS, taking the wax out of your ears.
Thank you.
and with some music from the film Bobby. That's music by Mark Isham. Well, I'm going to continue on with some more music from Mark Isham, as this is the score to the 2006 film Eight Below.
Thank you.
And with some music from the movie Eight Below, that's music by Mark Isham, who is our feature composer today. So if you're interested in any of the film, television, or video game music that I do play here on Visions and Sound, you can contact me here at the station at 884-CKMS. That's 884-2567. You can also try me online at visionsinsound2000@hotmail.com. Well, I'm going to quickly get into our next score. This is music from Of Mice and Men, also, of course, by Mark Isham.
Thank you.
began with just a little bit of music from the 1992 film. I was surprised to find out that Gary Sinise actually directed this film. It was the music from Of Mice and Men. Well, if you're interested in any of the film, television, or video game music that I do play here on Visions and Sound, you can contact me here at the station at 884-CKMS. That's 884-2567. You can also try me online at visionsinsound2000@hotmail.com. Well, welcome back to Visions and Sound as we're looking at the scores this week of composer Mark Isham. Now, before I continue with some more scores, here is part two of the interview that I did with Mark.
So now your most recent project is Next. So how did you come to work on that film?
I was actually approached by Lee Tamahori. He thought I was a good idea to score that picture. I met with him and loved the premise of the movie, liked Lee a lot. So I did it. It was a lot of fun. I mean, that's a very different sort of picture. That's, you know, you take your teenage boys and you just go sit in the third row and yell and scream and have a good time sort of picture. I tried to approach it with a little more of that sort of spirit of fun and you can push the envelope there. You can be a little over the top. You can do a sort of a bigger, grander gestures, and it's totally in keeping with the spirit of the filmmaker. So we tried some very sort of big things. We did a stereo orchestra, you know, an orchestra on the right, an orchestra on the left, mm-hmm. so that we could really get some spatial excitement going. That's you know, fun to do pictures like that.
For sure. So what inspired your approach to the score?
Basically, I took it from Lee, the very first conversation I had with Lee, who said, look, I mean, one of the reasons I want you to do this is not only, you know, can you handle all the action stuff and the big crash, bang, boom, but he said, you know, this story doesn't happen unless our main character is passionately in love with this woman. And he said the backbone of the story is a love story, and he says, I need a theme that can keep these guys connected throughout the whole movie. And so that became actually the first thing I wrote. The thing I spent the longest time on was just to get not only a theme, but then a theme that could break down into, you know, smaller motifs so that you could always keep these characters connected through the through the movie, no matter how much, you know, stuff was blowing up on the side.
So how involved did Lee become in your music, or were you just told, go compose and bring it back in a couple of weeks?
No, Lee was very connected to the whole thing, as was the picture editor. I mean, okay. Chris Wagner is a very, very highly regarded editor, and who's actually is a real master at post-production, especially in these types of films. So the two of them really were the collaborators here on terms of getting this score exactly the way it should be for the picture. And so I would go away and write a certain amount, and then I would have them come over, and, you know, the three of us would sit down and talk about what's working and what needs to be improved here. And in a picture like that especially, you know, where there's a lot of things where the score has to be very precise, I really like working directly with these guys and spending a lot of time with them, because then we can really fine-tune it to do exactly what it, you know, it can do best.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you mocking up your scores these days before they go to the score page?
Absolutely. With the type of schedules and budgets and everything we have, you know, I just don't like, you know, recording stuff that's not going to be right. And the technology allows you to make mock-ups that are pretty close. You might as well, you know, get all the hard work done before you're, you know, have 104 people waiting for you.
when you're mocking up a score, what this goes into instrument choice for a film?
Well, the mock-ups attempt to give them exactly what they will hear.
Okay.
I mean, I have obviously a lot of electronic, you know, synthesizers and stuff like that, because I do a fair amount of electronic scoring also. But then I've invested in a lot of sample libraries and can make a very convincing symphony orchestra and pretty much any other instrument that's needed, you know. So that I think that's part of the game these days for composers, that you have to sort of have your technological side up to the point where you don't let it limit you in your choices. I mean, that's the one thing I work hard at not doing. I say, well, I don't have anything that a sample of that, so I'm not going to write for it, you know. I say, well, if I have an idea, let's figure out how to mock it up.
Mm-hmm.
And see if it's going to work.
Okay.
And that may involve just, you know, spending, you know, a couple grand on having a particular player come in and just try things. That's certainly well within the possibilities.
Mm-hmm. So how much do you have to stay on the cutting edge of technology in this business? Like, do you take seminars to say, this is what's coming up? Do you follow the trade papers, that kind of thing? Or what do you do to stay on top?
I make it my studio assistant's job to constantly stay on top.
Okay.
And to let me know what's happening. I mean, we go to the NAMM show every year. We subscribe to all sorts of various publications. And I don't necessarily take the time to read them all, but he does. And he'll say, well, now here's some stuff you should read so you know that this is what's going to be happening. And I think it's very important because it allows you just to keep current with all the tools that are available. A lot of them can significantly help the process of knowing what you can do, what you might want to do, and the main thing is you want to be able to communicate it to others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I may have, you know, I have a pretty good musical imagination. That's my job.
Right.
But I'm going to have to be able to communicate my ideas to somebody before, you know, we take several hundred thousand dollars out and spend it, because I want people to approve the spending of that kind of money and not be disappointed after it's spent. So it's in my best interest to have every tool available to communicate to others, well, this is what I want to do, this is why it's going to be great. And don't you agree?
So what can you tell me about your involvement in the TV series The Black Donnellys?
Well, I've been working with Paul Haggis for a number of years on quite a number of projects.
Mm-hmm.
So he called me right from the beginning and told me that this was happening, and it was a great set of scripts. So I sat down and sort of tried to mock up how should we score this? And at first we thought, well, maybe this will be, you know, Irish. And then we thought, well, maybe that's just a little too on the nose. I mean, the story basically is, it's never really said, but it feels like it's in present time,
mm-hmm.
even though there's slight timeless quality to the whole thing also. So we decided to try and push the music in a very contemporary way. So I came up with this little idea, which allowed me to sort of feel very creative about this. And I said, well, you know, basically we're going to hire this. I'm going to create a mythical little band. And this is the band we're going to hire to score this. And they're going to have a couple of violinists, a couple of guitar players, but the band is led by a keyboardist who plays an old beat-up Fender Rhodes.
Mm-hmm.
And he has an organ, and he has a piano module. But that's about all. And they work in this club, and the drummer doesn't show up very often, and the violinists have other gigs, so they don't always show up. But occasionally the whole band is there, and that's who's going to score this. You know, all... this is unreal, but that it's a way of sort of defining those boundaries that I mm-hmm. mentioned, you know. And it worked very well. It was a great little premise by which to score this, because it gave us sort of a very limited resources. On the other hand, it allowed me to really push the boundaries of those resources. And it also made that the score felt very at home with all the songs,
right,
you know, that were licensed, because Paul licensed some really intriguing bands and stuff for the song part of the score. So it all felt of one world, which I think was very important.
Okay. Well, now, of course, as a composer, your job is to write music, but do you use silence as a composing tool?
Oh, always. Absolutely. I mean, the pause and the reentry is one of my most valuable tools. And that's why spotting a film, you know, deciding where music is going to start and stop is such an important part and something that can be played with all throughout the process. That's two of the most powerful things that I can do, is actually to start the music and to stop the music and have that juxtaposition of something and nothing.
Well, now you see the final product of a film or a TV show long before the general public sees it. Does that kind of ruin the movie-going experience for you?
Well, ruin might be too harsh a word, but it definitely changes it. I mean, it'll take a couple of years before I can go back and watch a movie that I've scored and sort of see it completely from an outsider's eyes, so to speak. Certainly, by the time a premiere comes around, I'm still wondering if I made the right choice in Bar 77. But, you know, I'm lucky. I get offered pretty great projects, and the films hold up well. So I'm always, you know, quite pleased with watching the film, even if I'm still inspecting it.
Well, can you explain your involvement in the film Gracie?
That was an approach directly from Davis Guggenheim, who said, you know, we're a small film, but we would love you to do it, and I'd like to show it to you. And he showed it to me, and I said, it's a wonderful film, and let's see if we can work something out. And we did, and it was a great experience. He is just a wonderful, wonderful guy. I really like this guy. He's very, very talented.
Now, you'll be also working with Paul Haggis again in a film called The Valley of Ella?
Ella. Yeah.
Okay. And so what can you tell me about that?
Well, that's a magnificent script that Paul's adapted from a novel, Tommy Lee Jones and Charlize Theron. And I actually just saw the full first pass screen the other day, and it really looks magnificent. He's he is a wonderful filmmaker, Mr. Haggis. He's really on a roll here. So we just spotted the first part of it the other day, so I'm just getting started. Have some ideas, but too early to say really what the score is going to be like.
Well, now, I remember hearing your score to Never Cry Wolf back in 1983 and being very, very impressed with it, even as a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
How would a score that you write today differ from one that you wrote at the beginning of your career?
I think the main difference would be just experience and willingness and ability to, how do I put this, I guess take on a larger vocabulary. When I first did Never Cry Wolf, I had never written anything for large orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
So when Carol asked me to score it, I said, well, look, I'm comfortable more in the electronic medium than anything else. And he said, well, that's fine. I think that's actually going to be a good way to score this picture. We ended up overdubbing some chamber strings, and of course, the lead instrument for the movie was the bassoon, and there was quite a lot of acoustic percussion. My comfort level at that time was just working in a studio with my electronic instruments and writing in that genre. The big difference is that now I've done quite a lot of orchestral scoring. I've gone back and educated myself in that whole world, and I feel equally at home there. So that, you know, like again, last year, Black Dahlia is a great example. That was an entirely acoustic orchestral score. So that's probably the biggest difference. Just a comfort level in picking a very precise genre, which will be the best choice for the film, because I feel, you know, totally comfortable in pretty much any world now.
Do you find when you're working on multiple projects that sometimes the music is interchangeable?
It depends. Obviously, if the films are similar in their emotional tone, then things can get intertwined. I've been fortunate in that when films overlap, that generally the genres have been quite different. In which case, then there's very little chance that, you know, a big bombastic action cue will surface into an intimate drama.
Mm-hmm. That's often something I've wondered, that are you working on multiple films and suddenly QA from film, you know, from this film, suddenly you'll start hearing a little bit more of it in, you know, in film B?
Well, I try to keep the schedules at a point where there isn't any threat of that happening. I mean, we just appropriate my time so that any possibility of that is kept to a minimum. But I find that I can separate them out quite well. I've never really had that problem.
Well, I really appreciate the time you give me today.
Certainly.
And just hope that your career continues on the incredible path that's been going. And,
well, thank you.
And hope to hear more of your music in the future.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
It's been a pleasure.
And it certainly was a pleasure to speak to Mark. So I'm going to quickly, because we're quickly running out of time here, quickly going to grab a little bit of the music to Crash. And this is all, of course, obviously music by Mark Isham, and I shall return momentarily.
So now I'm your most...
And that's not it. This is... with a very little bit of music from Crash. And if there's a, I know for a fact I'm going to be doing another show on Mark's music, so we'll hear a little bit more of Crash in a future program. I'm going to get right to the score to Next. And this is the Lee Tamahori film starring Nicolas Cage. So I'll be back to wrap up the show in just a little bit. We'll be right back. Well, that's all for me this week. I hope you've enjoyed this look at the music of composer Mark Isham. Well, the summer series continues next week with a Fistful of Visions, a look at the Hollywood Western. I'll end off this week with some more music from the film Next, and I'll be back next week with more Visions in Sound.